Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
And may I have your name, sir?
Russell Ratliff.
Mr. Ratliff, if you would hold on for just one moment, I think that we will get started with you very shortly, and know that your attorney wanted to make a statement, I believe, at the beginning. So we'll get your attorney's statement. Just give us a moment to everybody get into the room. And Mr. Johnson, may I pass this on to you, sir, just in case?
Yes, sir.
And do you have any objection to our listening to your attorney up front, sir?
No, not at all.
Okay. Okay. Just as soon as they close the door, we will be ready to move forward to the... After this statement, then, Mr. Johnson, I'll turn it over to you. I don't want to hear the statement first.
Okay.
Okay, well, good morning, and let's still come in, we'll get started. I want to make sure that everybody who wants to be in the room is in the room at this time, and statement. We'll listen to that first, and then we will move forward after your statement, ma'am.
Thank you. Members of the board, I'm Holly Diesel. I have the privilege of representing Russell Ratliff. I'll call him Russell because I call most of my clients by my first name, and they call me by my first name, so that's how I'll do it. This is a tough case. It's a tough case because it involves a murder. Heinous crime. There's no way to try to put a spin on it, and I would never do that.
Before we do this, may I just ask you one question, please, ma'am, Attorney Lisa? You're not going to make a request today to continue the hearing, am I correct?
We are not.
Okay. Then if that's the case, then please have a seat right here for just a moment, and I have requested the Honorable Mr. Michael Johnson if he would conduct the hearing, and that's the reason that I'm doing it this way, because I thought you was going to make a statement otherwise, but since you're not, I'm going to ask Mr. Johnson, Honorable Mr. Johnson, if he would conduct the hearing at this point.
Good morning, sir. Could you please state your name and your ADC number for us for the record?
My name, sir, is Russell Ratliff, DOC number 042424.
Okay, so you're appearing before the Arizona Board of Executive Clemency. I'm going to introduce you to the board members that will be conducting your hearing today. Can you hear me, sir?
Clearly.
Is there a volume on that phone board that you have?
Not that I can tell, sir. I could barely hear the lawyer when she was talking, or Mr. Wright.
Okay.
Can you hear me any better now, sir?
A little.
Can you hear me any better now?
Yes, sir.
I guess you just have to put the mic up.
Can you hear me any better, sir?
Yes, sir.
All right. Okay, sir. You're ready for the Arizona Board of Executive Clemency. I'm going to introduce you to the board members that will be conducting the hearing today. To my far left is the Honorable Luis Quinones. Coming down the line is the Honorable David Dill. In the middle, sir, you have the Honorable Dr. C.T. Wright, who's our board chair. And next to me, to my immediate left, is the Honorable Mrs. Gail Rittenhouse, sir. My name is Michael Johnson, sir. I'm going to be acting as your panel chair this afternoon. Mr. Ratliff, I'm going to go over some information with you. Then, after I go over that information, work. I'm going to have you make some comments to us. You do have an attorney here that is representing you, and we also have some supporters here for you, and we also have some victims. So the way that we're going to do this morning is that we're going to go over some information with you. The board, if we have any questions, we'll go over that with you. We'll have the attorney, either she can make a statement before, or if she wants to wait until the witnesses or your supporters actually come up and speak, she may do that. We'll make that determination. And then after we complete with you and your attorney and your supporters, we then are going to go to the victims. We have the victims do have a representative, I believe, from the county attorney's office that's here. And then we'll talk with them, sir. Then the board will go into discussion and make a determination as to what the board is going to do, okay?
Yes, sir.
All right. So you're appearing before this board for absolute discharge or regular parole or home arrest, is that right?
Yes, sir.
Because you're currently serving a life sentence for murder. You became parole eligible on October 15th of 2009. You had served a previously 5-year unrelated sentence for aggravated assault. You were released on November 9th of 83, and this offense was committed less than a year later on October 15th, 1984, and you were on parole at the time that this offense was committed that you'd actually in custody for. Is that right, sir?
No, sir. That's not right.
Okay, that's not right, sir.
Okay. One point is I was released in September of 83. The second point is I completed parole when I was off parole.
Okay, I'm just going
to... My jacket was sealed, and my foster dad had helped me out to get a job, and I was working for a government service.
Okay. I was going by the documentation that we have that basically said that they had released a month later, November 9th, 83, and I said that the offense was committed less than a year later, and at the time that the offense was committed, that you were on parole. However, that's the documentation that we have here, sir. If that's wrong, then I will stand corrected, sir.
Okay. Yeah, I was off full probation. I only had 6 months when I was discharged, and I was discharged in September of 83.
Okay.
And I had stayed on, I think, parole for like the 6 months, and then I was off.
Okay. Sir?
And then I... Yes, sir.
Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead.
I didn't mean to interrupt you, sir. I wasn't on no paper when I committed this crime.
Okay. All right. Well, sir, I see that according to your institutional progress report, you have completed several programs since you've been incarcerated to include cognizant thinking, cultural diversity, conflict resolution. You've completed Big Rig Truck. Anti-violence project work, thinking straight, along with several other cages raised, along with several other classes that you take since you have been incarcerated. It looks like your last class that you took, a program that you had, was in January 21st of 18, basic anti-violence project workshop certificate that was presented to you. According to your release plan, it says that you will be residing with your daughter, Nicole Kimball, if you were released at 5861. I'm not going to read all of the address out there. It says that you plan on seeking employment as soon as possible upon your release to parole. It also says that you have several family and friends' letters of support that's included in the file, as well as a letter that states that you have a job waiting for you once you release, sir. It looks like you haven't had any discipline in the last 6 years. Your last discipline looks like was in August of 2009 to 2012, which was actually for a refusal to program. Is that about right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So it looks like you had a commutation hearing, phase one commutation hearing that you had, which was in April of 2002, and that was not passed on to a phase two. Then you had another one in October of 2007, which was not passed on. After that, you had 9 parole hearings for parole, home arrest, absolute discharge since 2010. And the last one was actually September 13th of 16, and all of those were denied. Is that about right, sir?
Yes, sir.
All right. According to the pre-sentencing investigation information that we have, it says that on October 15th, 1984, at approximately 6:50 a.m., the victim, a 22-year-old female, was stabbed numerous times while in the rear parking lot of her apartment complex. 6401 West Thomas. This incident was observed by the victim's brother-in-law, who was driving by and saw the subject later identified to be the defendant on top of the victim with a knife in his hand, stabbing her repeatedly. The victim's brother-in-law chased the defendant through the apartment complex, but he got away from him at that time. It says that after you were arrested, they found the inventory of the property and found you to be carrying identification and pictures of several different females.
Yes, sir.
Because originally when this thing originally happened, when police talked to you, you said that you witnessed the victim being stabbed and briefly saw two Mexican males running away. They asked you why you did not call for help. You stated that because you were ex-con and you learned not to be a snitch at that time. So I'm not going to go through all of the details of the actual assault, sir, but what I am going to do is ask you, Mr. Randolph, two things. One of them, I want you to explain to this board what was going on and what occurred during this period of time. And then I also want you to explain to this board what is it that has happened that has changed you since that period of time, sir.
Sir, I was a 20-year-old, claimed to be acting adult. Okay, I was on drugs, and I wasn't thinking as an adult, wouldn't think. My brain wasn't mature enough. Okay, I take full responsibility, and I can't even imagine, you know what I mean, the victim's family, after all these years, you know, I know they won't forgive me. I know they have, you know what I mean, it hurts. I'm taking one of their family members off this earth. You know, I was full of rage. I had a lot of issues, okay, a lot of drug issues. All right, there's nothing I can do or say to them that would heal their hearts. All I can do is ask for their forgiveness and pray that they would forgive me. I am deeply sorry and deeply remorseful. And you asked me, what was the second question, sir?
Well, let me ask you a couple more questions about this, sir. Why did you understand that the issues of being 20 years old and some of the things that were happening, but why did you attack this female?
I had a burst of anger. I couldn't control my anger. I've had a past before that. I had a head injury. Okay, I had a brain injury. I had a couple of accidents. Okay, and I'm not trying to use that as an excuse. No, don't get me wrong. I'm not trying to use it as a crutch. I'm just trying to let you know what had happened. Okay, I was in traction for over 18 months, and it messed me up for most of my life. Okay, I went to when I was going through counseling, when I was in the foster home, when I was with my probation officer, I had counselors there. Okay, I had somebody to go to, and then I was put in a fishbowl after doing the 5 years that I had done. Okay, for another assault in juvenile, and they reprimanded me in adult court. Okay, I was on a whole cocktail of medications because I was having seizures. All right, and I'm not using that as an excuse either. Okay, but what I'm saying is my history was violent. Okay, so the state did the right thing to put me in an institution. I have to pay for the crime that I have committed. I take full responsibility for that.
All
I tried to fulfill what the board has asked me to do. Okay? And I'm just, like I said, I look at my family's come back in my life. I look at my daughter, and all I'm doing is just hug her and hold her. You know, I mean, she hasn't been in my life since she was 12. This last year, when I reconnected with my family, with my ex-wife, and my ex-wife, I adore her, okay, and all my family's come back in my life. And just the emotions, and I can feel how Mr. White feels.
Okay, so let me ask you a question, sir. I understand what you're saying. Yes, sir. I'm trying to understand, and I know that you said that you were had a history of violence, but what was it about this victim that made you attack her? What was it that made you attack this particular victim?
Like I started saying, I didn't get off track, excuse me. I had a lot of issues, family issues with my mother and the way that she raised me and the men that she had in her life.
Uh-huh.
And I had a lot of anger towards her. Okay. And I've been trying to apologize for that ever since I had to become a man. Okay. And she's, I don't know where she's at. She might be passed away or so. I don't know. I haven't talked to her in over almost 40 years.
So, Mr. Radloff, what I'm trying to understand, so maybe you're not really understanding me, but what I'm trying to understand, sir, for this board, I am trying to understand what caused you to attack this female. And the other thing I'm trying to understand is why, you know, what would prevent you from not doing this again if you were released? And I'm not hearing you really explain your actions or your reason for such a brutal attack on a female that you stabbed and killed for no reason.
Something that I see when I was messed up on drugs kind of reminded me, I think, seeing a flashback or something of my mother. Okay, that's where I was at, and how I'm trying to explain it to you, sir.
Okay.
Okay. I believe that's what was the trigger that set me off. Okay. And I've tried to work with that continually, year after year after year. Okay. And like I said, you know, trying to push things off on my juvenile history, I've never tried to do that. I did that when I was a kid. I don't do that when I'm an adult. I take full responsibility for that. Okay. And like I said, I'm just trying to do parallels on taking my own responsibility in my hands, and I have for years. I hope I've answered your question.
I said that you've taken quite a bit of programming since you've been incarcerated, which is good. I'm glad that you've taken the program. You haven't had a lot of discipline in the last 6 years. I think that is also good. I am just trying to understand. I have gone through your file, and I've looked through some of the reports that we have. We don't have a complete copy of the police report. I know that you've gone through, as a juvenile, you went through several different psychological evaluations, and they came up with kind of different opinions on what they actually did, depending on which one that you actually talked to at the time. But, sir, I am concerned about this particular incident that you had, and if it was because you may have had a flashback of your mother, I'm just wondering what would prevent this incident from happening again. Are you having another flashback or attacking an innocent person if you're not fully aware of what is the trigger that set you off?
Well, I was aware of it. Okay, I was being angry on the way that she was treated, the men that was in her life. Okay, would always abuse her and beat her.
So,
okay, I'm fully aware and capable of that.
So,
okay, the way you show affection, and I was just so angry with the way that I was raised that I just blew up. It wasn't just a particular person, it was my mother. Okay, and I had to identify with that. And kids keep things inside.
say you're grown, sir, explain to me what that means when you say you're grown. From that.
You know,
what does that mean?
When you grow, you mature. Every actual man has to look in the mirror, you know what I mean, and he has to take care of, he has to mature. Okay? And if he accepts his own responsibilities, then he's not a man.
Uh-huh.
All right? He's always blaming somebody else for his actions.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, like I said, I'll take the full responsibility for this. Okay? And I always have. All right? And I know that the reports there, because I've sat and read them, Mr. or Mrs. Ortiz or something like that, the psychologist report, and the psychology report even stated that I have a protective nature, okay? And I've been like that. It's like a fight or flight syndrome. And I've identified that, and I'll try to work with that through these courses.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I'll fully mature, and I'm fully adjusted on situations that us men have to take care of. Okay.
Okay, so sir, let me ask you another question, which you haven't mentioned. I know that you said that maybe a flashback of your mother, but according to the information that we have as a juvenile, you had a history of voyeurism. Would you want to go into women's homes? Going to women's homes in an exceptional manner. The incident that you did, the burglary and aggravated assault, where you had 5 years, that was an incident where you went into a house and was viewing a woman, and subsequently you ran out of the house. But that was it. But you haven't addressed any of those issues that seem to be, and I'm not sure if that was part of the issue why you attacked the victim in which you stabbed and killed.
No, sir. That was completely different. That was like a peep of time issue, and the officer wrote it up as that because I was looking through the window. I would go into houses and sit in their living room, and yeah, I would go in the bedroom, and they said that I had touched the woman. Okay, I had touched the bed. All right, I did not touch the woman.
Okay.
Okay, in a sexual manner. There was no sexual in this issue.
Not at all. No, you're right, sir. You're right about that. But you know, it says that basically that you were doing them in a sexual manner. That there may have been some sexual gratification to you. And absolutely.
Sir, that was the way that they wrote the report up when I was 11, 12 years old.
Okay, so
okay, I can't defend that. I can't defend that or fight what you're saying, okay, or answer you in a logical manner.
So
I can only reflect what I remember. And I don't remember much because I'm in a coma. I was in a coma for 4 months.
Okay, so.
Okay, so I vaguely remember that issue.
So you may remember that issue, and you haven't had any issues of voyeurism since then, or is that because those issues doesn't appear to have been addressed?
No, sir, because they haven't allowed me to see a professional.
Okay.
Okay, in this system, they have denied me, okay, even when I put in each year to see the psychologist or psychiatrist, they said, I can't dictate treatment. I can't get treatment in here. Okay? And I have repeatedly asked year after year since I started going to the board in 09, repeatedly.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? I have no issues with lawyers.
Okay.
All right? My issue was, I wanted to find out what a normal home was when I was a juvenile. Okay? All right? I haven't been doing any of this stuff that they said I was doing back in my juvenile years. At all.
Okay, sir. I want to see if the board has any additional questions for you, sir, at this time. Mr. Quinones.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Mr. Radloff.
Yes, sir.
I will begin by saying that this board's priorities are public safety, victims' concerns, and inmates' rights, and certainly inmates' rights. Regarding whether or not we can safely safety department, returning to the community, I have to tell you that you sound irritable and short. For example, when my colleague was stating that he thought that you were on probation around the time of the crime, it turns out that probation had been completed when you committed this murder. You sounded annoyed, and I'm concerned about where you're at right now in terms of your worldview.
Can I answer?
Yes, sir.
Okay. First of all, I can't really see you. All I can see is your hands. I can't see your face. And second of all, I wasn't really annoyed. I was just, I didn't know how to answer because I can't hear. Okay? These phones don't really work, and I was just trying to give them the best answer I could. I'm not agitated. I'm just, like I said, I still, till this day, try to do the right things after 34 years. I'm not really agitated. I get more expressive because also my kids miss me. Okay, I want to do everything I can to honor them. All right, they were 12 or 14 when I came in. They're now 46 and 47. All right, so I'm trying to give them the utmost respect. My family, okay, while they're sitting here listening to this. And yeah, I'm a little expressive when I talk because I'm emotional. I haven't had to deal with emotions in this prison environment. Okay, so I'm just trying to give the best answers I can, not to pacify you, just to show you that I do have emotions, and yes, I understand about the life that I took and what the victims' families are going through, because before I didn't care. When I first came in, I didn't care about anything. Okay, I didn't see a way out. I didn't understand it, that I would be here at this time and have been here since 2009. I just didn't. I wanted to get the right answers out from what I remember because it's been so long ago, too, on the probation stuff.
Okay. Thank you, sir. And I appreciate your response. I can hear that this is emotional, and I don't mean to be dismissive of that. You've been in the prison system for a long time, but as one voting board member, I have to look very hard as to whether or not we can safely return an individual to the community. That's a hard decision that we have to make on behalf of the people of Arizona. I will not ask any further questions at this point. Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
Rabbi, let me just make a correction because I keep hearing you use the word probation, and certainly you were not on probation, but the report had indicated that you were on parole, that you had been released from prison early, and as a result of that, you were on parole. You may have completed that parole, but the report does not indicate that your parole was complete at that time. However, like I said, we don't have a complete copy of the police report, so that could be right, but there was no probation. It was parole after being released from prison. Okay?
Okay, sir. Yes, sir.
Sir, I'm going to go to your attorney at this time. Ms. Giesel, is that right?
That's right.
Okay. Ms. Giesel, I don't know if you want to make a comment now or if you want to have the supporters come up and make a comment or what order they're going to speak in, but certainly I give you that opportunity and privilege at this time to do this as you feel.
Thank you. Members of the board, I started off a little earlier what I was going to say, but I will say, man, this is a hard case. Let me clarify, I am pro bono. Mr. Radloff's wife provided some funding for some expenses, but I've worked on this case pro bono, and because I think it represents a tragedy in our justice system. Going back to when Marshall Redlock was 14 years old, and back to social services failures before that. This is a man who was born as a child into a family with no father and a mother who had about 14 husbands. all of them abusive. He was removed from her custody. He was sent to the boys' community home. He was sent to ASH as a juvenile twice. We don't do that anymore. It was such a terrible program that the forensic psychiatrists in the state said, you can't do that. So they stopped it. The tests that he was given when he was 11 and 12 are not used for juveniles. They were inappropriate. They're no longer used. And even if you want to believe what the test said, they were inconclusive. So at 14, he gets in trouble and is tried as an adult with his first felony and sent to Rincon for 5 years, where he got no programming. He came out and he went back to what he had been doing, which was very serious polysubstance abuse, polypharmacy abuse. Now, let's talk about those drugs, because I don't think Russell understood the question. Not that it wasn't a good question. I'm a lawyer. I ask that question all the time, and I think I'm asking exactly what I want to say. Mr. Radloff was abusing regularly when he was released at 19 from prison with the childhood background I've just given you. He had no social services. He wasn't in child health. He wasn't in anything like DES. This is a kid who was poor, who was abused, who was addicted to drugs, and now let's talk about those drugs because they explain the crime. He was using cocaine, PCP, which is a known hallucinogenic, which triggers violence. So I was driving them down in the ER when they come in and put them in physical restraints and stab them in the thigh with Haldol. That's the only way you control somebody, is Mr. Rat, who's on PCP. I come from a family of law enforcement. U.S. Marshal, Chief of Police, Memphis, Tennessee, TBI Director, Tennessee Bureau of Investigation. So I'm not soft on any of this. But that's what you do to somebody like Mr. Radloff at 19 when he comes in high on PCP. Speed, and he was free-basing. And all of that happened within the 96-hour period before this crime. He comes home, he's high as a kite from free-basing and from using PCP, and he commits a heinous crime, a heinous murder, which cannot be justified, which cannot be excused, and these victims have every right to show up and say, don't ever release that animal. He will always be a threat. Do not do it. Do not disrespect us. Keep him locked up. And I would say all those things are in the place. And that's why this is a hard case. Because it requires you to look back 45, 50 years and say, why do we have this man sitting where he's sitting? And what can I do in my head to analyze all these factors? Well, if we want to analyze all his history before he went into DOC, we have to conclude that he was a victim of a terrible system, an abusive mother who ought to be in prison, who ought to be prosecuted for child abuse and neglect, and maybe he wouldn't be here. Well, we can't put her in prison, so we got to look at what's going on. Now, by any risk factor, and there are all these scales, every state uses a different one. If you look to try to use evidence-based quantification of his risk, his age at first commitment, juvenile at ABC as an adult at 14, train wreck childhood, that would give him a point or two. If you go to other incarcerations, juvenile commitment, that would give him a couple of points because it was for a crime, a pretty violent. Employment history prior to prison, he was working. He was holding a job at Redlaw. So that would be a zero. Commitment offense, first degree murder, non-repetitive, violent, heinous crime, but it's not the crimes that we see that recur. Security threat group membership, nope. And to survive as long as he has, I represent SCG guys. I've been here before. But to survive as long as he has as a white guy in DOC and not be an SCG, he's had his head on straight as to how you conform in a community to rules without seeking a violent alternative. That is a plus. He completed his high school GED shortly after he went in, actually within a decade. He has no disciplinary record, but it's exemplary. How many guys do you see going in for murder who have violent tendencies go 22 years without any violent disciplinary ticket, no major violation since 2007? And 2007 did not involve refusing to program. If you look on the website, refusing to program for work, he had worked a long shift in the kitchen. They told him to go to the front and start serving. He didn't want to do it, and he refused to serve. That was in 2012. So it wasn't refusing programming, it was refusing work. Current custody level. He's as low as he can get because of his index crime. He's gone down every chance he had. The ticket he had, every prisoner involved in those riots back in 1996 got a ticket. I happened to be in court with a federal judge when all the Section 1983 cases on that stuff came out. It was a mess. His current age, 54. All those factors mitigate against risk in the community. But the most important thing that mitigates against risk is the current system is so much better. If I could use a four-letter word, I would. It is so much better today in terms of community corrections than the stuff he grew up in as a child and a juvenile. This community abandoned his mother and then our social system. And he wouldn't be. We have a different system today. So, community corrections. He embraces programming. He's done everything he can. He wants home arrest, the most restrictive form of parole that there is. He follows rules. He'll do well with his parole supervisor, with his officer. And he can, when he comes out, not only get in treatment, he can get in the access program. He can get in the community mental health program for ongoing assessment and help. And he will have, as he's noted, a job. And he's got a strong family. Not many families who lose somebody, who murdered somebody, stick with them 34 years. But his essentially adopted daughter, his family's here, his wife wrote a letter. She's recovering in a care home after broken hip surgery. But she typed her little letter, and she got it over to us the night before she went in for surgery. I don't see many clients like that. Most of my clients have, mothers like Rusty. So this is a hard case. I wouldn't want to face these victims and have to make a decision. But if he had a bunch of money, we asked for several continuances. We were trying to raise some money for a full-blown behavioral risk assessment by Donna Robinson, who does a lot in California. She's chief psychologist at one of the state prisons. She does a lot of reports going to the governor of California. She's the best there is. She's going to give us a discount if we get. But I don't want to continue. I want the board to tell Mr. Radloff what he needs to do and bring it back in if you don't grant home release, which I believe this case compellingly meets the requirements. Then bring him back in 6 months and tell him exactly what you want. He can't afford this assessment. So that raises a really interesting legal issue, which is that poor guys who are going to predominantly be minorities and women, poor inmates will sit in prison, and wealthy inmates, I got a lot of those who do well, get out. Because they can go hire Bayless Health or Jack Potts or Donna Robinson or any of the others, John Tome, any of those guys. So this is really about what kind of justice system we have, what kind of correction system we have. Do poor guys sit in prison and rich guys get out? Or do we trust our community correction system to impose requirements as stringent as you want to give you the assurance that he's going to be in one place monitored electronically if necessary, compliant. You've got the opportunity to put him on a choke chain and a short one. And that's what I ask you to do. So I'd like to have his daughter come up.
Before his daughter come up, let
me. I'm happy to answer questions.
So you said that he was on cocaine, PCP, speed, and freebase at the time, that night before this incident, correct?
He was dipping cigarettes in PCP and speed and freebase.
Okay, so it's just, I'm not an expert in this, and I'm sure you're not an expert in it either.
Well,
but
sure, if I may say so. It's a way to be on go and not go stop, okay? I was doing a lot of things out there with drugs,
okay?
And it tore me up.
So
I've been clean for 31 years.
I understand, Mr. Radloff, but let me finish with my question with Ms. Giesel, okay?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Okay, so it's just always been my kind of conclusion that if someone's doing cocaine, PCP, freebase, and dipping it, that does some permanent damage. It does some permanent mental damage, but if he's doing all of those things, but according to the information that we have in the report, that he got up that morning, went outside to smoke a cigarette, and walk around apartments like that's his normal routine. I mean, it wasn't like he was totally out. It didn't say that. It says he got up, he walked outside, smoke a cigarette, walk around apartments like he normally do as he waits for his girlfriend to go to work. So I'm just trying to trying to understand that. So that's not what he indicated happened at the time.
Absolutely. It is typical, it is common for somebody who is a young, otherwise healthy male to be able to do a stupendous amount of drugs in a fairly short period of time, regardless of the conduct during the period that they were using drugs, be able to get up and go to work or do whatever it is that they're doing. That's a phenomenon, particularly of PCP and cocaine, which have pretty short half-lives. And by that, we mean the period of time that it takes for half of the drug in your system to clear. These drugs, now, the half that's left with PCP, you can have residual problems, flashbacks, you can have episodes that are triggered. It is, of course, originally a veterinary drug used for sedation and so forth with large animals. But with cocaine, it clears. I'm not aware, and if this is something you want to come back and present on, I'm not aware of any evidence that this kind of drug abuse in a period of time for a couple of years in your late teens has residual brain damage, causes brain damage with effects that are apparent years later. Not true if it's an infant, not true. We know from infants that are born with Nieve-Lassman syndrome and so forth. We know those kids are likely to have problems, but not in otherwise healthy males in their late teens. The other problem is this head injury. The head injury issue is one that apparently has cleared, as we know some of these concussions do. The seizures diminish. And he was comatose. It was a joint and gym accident. He was comatose, treated, and those symptoms have cleared. So there's no medical evidence. And we had Dr. Jack Potts look at the case, and he gave us some insights on it, which I have shared.
Yes.
We weren't able to have him testify because he couldn't complete his report, so we asked for a continuance. It was denied. My view on that is I don't let my clients sit. I come and present the best case possible and ask you to either release him or give us the very specific things that you want to see and a timetable to come back and be accountable for that.
Okay. So I wanted to address that with you, too,
mm-hmm.
because this board does not make a determination between rich and poor.
I understand
what has happened in the past, but I would tell you what this board does strongly look at and what this board is obligated to look at.
And we can't tell you what to do or not to do or make a recommendation, but I will tell you that this board does look very strongly at whether a person can be released back into the community. And this board feels strongly that if that person's released back into the community, that that person would not reoffend.
Absolutely.
That is what this board's major object is, and it is to protect the welfare and the safety of the community, as well as to make sure we protect the rights of the inmates. So I just wanted to just kind of make it clear, and I know you talk about evidence-based qualifications, but those would be some things that actually may be used as court, but for this board, you know, we have a strong responsibility to make sure that the person that we parole or release back into the community, that we feel as though that person will not be committing any other crimes. And that's a hard decision to actually make, but it has nothing to do with rich or poor or representation or no representation, because we try to be fair to all the people that come before this board, and this board will be doing the same thing during this period of time. But I just, there was just some comments that was talked about rich or poor, and I do understand that he had a rough childhood and abusing. There's side reports in there from that. He survived in prison for a period of time without belonging to an SDG type group. But, you know, basically, it's just been my experience since I've been on this board that most inmates that have any type of sexual offense do not belong to STGs. And matter of fact, most of the STGs that I've seen, more inmates come in and say that they, when released, did not want to go to halfway houses because of the crime. So that could be a possibility. But I just wanted to just comment on some of that, because I think that the crime itself has a lot to do with him not belonging to an STG. But I do want to, because we do have other cases, I do want to move on, and you can go ahead and present who's going to come up and testify.
Let me clarify. I don't suggest that this board, for 1 minute, that you make decisions based on socioeconomic status. I don't suggest that. What I suggest is that our legal system favors those who can afford things, like a male psychiatrist to do a risk assessment, or somebody else. And Mr. Radcliffe can't, unless somehow we can get some more community resources. So I don't suggest that about the board. I suggest that the process favors those who can bring to this board information that Mr. Radcliffe can't, because he's not. Now, on the STG, I agree. I do a ton of STG work. I tried one of the two STG cases, Mark Cook and Larry Prince, in federal court, and their STG validations were returned. So, and that was in the early 90s. So I know STGs. And I'm fortunate to do work for all of the groups, because I don't play favorites, I don't see color, I don't see ethnicity, and so on. His crime was murder. It wasn't rape. He would be a welcomed member of many STGs. He's got the street cred, two terms, a GB term, age 14 to 19. That gives you a lot of points in some of those STG gas methods. So I understand what you're saying, but that GB record was sealed, and his crime when he went in was for an assault. So I think he... My point of mentioning the STGs is when I look at an STG member, I look at their choice. You make a choice to join an STG because you want that choice to be part of your life. He had that choice and he turned it down. Hasn't exercised that. That's good judgment in a situation where he has had extraordinarily bad judgment and bad conduct in the past.
I think that we've had enough of this. Maybe just move on to some other aspects. And I'm not cutting off.
I know you're not. You have had enough.
We've got a number of things to get done today.
I'm just going to be repeating, so I won't. I want to have Nicole come up, Nicole Kemper, and she's his daughter, not his biological daughter, but the daughter he was raising while he was living with her mother, age 19 to 20, before he went back. And she will give her views, and this won't be easy for her, but she's going to do a good job. She's going to speak from the heart.
Hey, Nicole Kemper. My mom and dad were in the process of getting married when this happened. We all have problems in our life. There is not nobody on this earth that is perfect. Very sorry what happened to Luffy. She did not deserve that whatsoever. Nobody deserved that. My dad also deserves a chance, just like everybody else. Okay. He is a good person. He does have a good heart. We all make mistakes. Granted, we do face up to him, and we do do the time. He is a good person. He really is. He has helped me through a lot, and I haven't had a very good childhood either, and he's really helped me through a whole lot on that. There's a lot that he can do. I mean, he is grateful. He is sorry for what he has done. When this all happened, I was 12 years old. Okay, my dad, he actually turned himself in. Cops didn't have to come and get him. Nobody had to get come and get him. He turned himself in. Okay, that should be taken into consideration, too. Okay. I really, honestly, I feel up for Luffy's family. I really do. There's, we can't take back what's happened in the past. All we can do is look forward. And so every day, you know, I know she had a kid. Every day that child wakes up and her mother's not there. I understand how that is. Believe me, my biological dad is gone. But that's totally different. So all I'm asking is just give him another chance. You know, everybody deserves chances. Everybody does wrong. Nobody's perfect. And we all know that. Not even the law enforcement is perfect. Please give him a chance.
Just a minute. I'm sure if the board has any questions. I'll wait till the attorney speaks. Go ahead. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Are there any more supporters who would like to speak? Any more supporters that would like to speak?
The board has a letter from Mrs. Hughes, who's in the care home.
Yes, we do have that letter. We also have your letter that you wrote to the board. We have that information with us. Okay, if there's no more supporters that are going to speak, we're now going to go to the victims. I do see the county attorney that's there, and I give you the opportunity to introduce yourself, and then tell us how you'd like to proceed, or what order that you'd like the victims to come up here.
Thank you. Good morning, members of the board. I'm Chairman Wright. I do want to clarify something. I know I've appeared before you as Maricopa County Attorney, Deputy County Attorney in the Capital Litigation Bureau, but I recently went to work for the Arizona Voice for Crime Victims. So I'm not here today as a prosecutor, but I am here today on behalf of the victims.
And what congratulations.
Thank you. What we would like to do is have the victims come forward. I've left it to them about the order in which they'll proceed, but I have advised them to state their full name.
She's not in here. She couldn't stay. This poor December, who is the daughter of the boy. This is the first time she's attended. She just couldn't do it. So she's outside, and she asked me to speak for her, which I do every year. I've been to every one of these hearings. So, first and foremost, thank you for allowing me to speak for her. The first thing I want to say is, as she's sitting back there, the thing that triggered her was hearing him say he would like to get out to hold his daughter. This is a young woman who basically was raised with me since her mom was murdered. So she's like a little sister to me. I watched her grow up without her mom. I watched her get her first heartbreak without a mom there to tell her how to handle it. I watched her go to prom without a mom to help her get dressed. I watched her grow up as a young woman without a mother there to show her how to be a woman. I watched her ask me questions about what her mom sounds like. Because she didn't even have that now. She didn't even get the memory of what did my mom sound like. I hear the attorney, I hear the daughter, stepdaughter, I'm not sure exactly what the relationship is, but I hear you guys say that we should give him a second chance. I present to you, this is more than a second chance. He's been locked up for other reasons. He had his chance to get out and be a productive member of the society. He attacked a woman before this woman, and his crimes only escalated. So we gave him a chance, and his crime escalated to murder. I understand what the attorney was speaking about when she says his upbringing wasn't great. And his life, a story was given to you guys about his life and his upbringing. Let me give you a story about a little girl's upbringing. She grew up in a home without a mom. She didn't live with us, but we lived close to her. She grew up in a home with a woman that didn't really embrace her as a daughter. And it's hard for me to speak this because I watched a girl grow up without her mom by no choice of hers and by no choice of her mother's. She's grown up and become a wonderful, productive person in this society. However, she deals with anxiety. She feels fearful. The only thing that gets her through day in and day out to feel safe is that this man is behind bars. There's times that she wakes up in the middle of the night and she calls me random hours with nightmares of what could possibly happen to her. I will tell you a story. Last week she just called and told me about she was in a bathroom in an airport and there was a woman there with her young daughter. The little girl was crying and very anxious and she needed to use the restroom and she was in the next stall and she could hear the mom singing to calm the daughter down. And she broke out in full tears because she said, is that what moms are supposed to do? This is what she called to ask me. Is this what moms do? Because she didn't have that. So, she felt like going through these hearings is quote an unusual punishment. This man made a decision. So, albeit whatever she's saying, the drugs, this, that, it was a decision to me to do drugs. It's a decision. It may have not been his decision to grow up with the childhood that he grew up with, but it definitely would have not been my aunt's decision for her daughter to grow up without her. That was taken from her. I tend to agree with the board member when he said that from his understanding, also from my understanding, working in the courts, working for the city prosecutor's office, that drugs has a permanent effect on your brain. That brings me some concern. How do we know he's going to be okay to be in the community? I'm not going to lie to you. I come to these things every single year, and the only solace that I have is that he's behind bars. If he gets out, who's to say he's not, his anger or rage, as he used, is not going to be lashed out towards us for coming and speaking against him. And it's not really against him. It's against allowing somebody like this in the community, because really, he says we'd never forgive him. Let me explain something to you. We have forgiven you. Otherwise, we would not be able to
have you. Let me stop you.
I need to address the board.
Yes, ma'am.
To the board, we have forgiven him. Otherwise, we would not be able to move on with our lives. We didn't forgive him for him. We forgave him for us.
Okay.
So, when we come here, it's not about retaliation. It is truly about our safety. It's about women in general safety. As he said, he just went into a rage. My aunt allegedly reminded him of his mom. How that is, I have no idea. They were around the same age. They're two different ethnicities. No clue. Another thing I want to talk to you guys about is the multiple IDs he had of the different women. Has that even been explored? It seems like that's kind of gazed over. Why would he have so many women's IDs? Are there more women out there that we haven't found? Would there have been more victims? I present to this board that I believe there will be more victims if he's put out. So, he just got reunited with his family. According to the attorney, she is very impressed with the fact that the family has stuck with him 34 years, yet by his own accord and his own account, he just got reunited with them. So that is not fully the truth. I was here, the brother-in-law you read about, that's my dad. Let me tell you about October 15, 1984 at 7 a.m. My mom and dad went to work every day. Same way, same time. They lived very near Loopy Way. Loopy and my mother, who's here, work together. My mom and dad rolled around the corner and heard her scream. My mom and dad, not just the brother-in-law, the sister, also witnessed her sister being stabbed over and over and over again. I know firsthand, working in the system, that to stab somebody, to feel a knife going through somebody's flesh, over and over and over again, more than 20 times, I believe, that is a serious hatred crime. Serious. So, to stand here and say, oh, well, we should just overlook everything because he had a bad childhood. How can you do that? How can you look at Lupe White's daughter, who's a woman, in the face and say, we feel he's going to be productive in society? I don't know how you can do that. Now, I will say this. My dad showed up to one of these hearings, I believe, two years ago. He's remorseful. He feels so bad for the family and what he's done. Let me explain to you what happened during that hearing. I believe Dr. Wright was here. I don't know if you can, I don't think you would have been here. Let me explain to you what happened. My dad got up here and explained to the board what he witnessed. This man taunted my dad during this hearing. His words, quote unquote, well, why didn't you do something when you were there? Here speaks a man of how much remorse he's had for 15 years. The first time you get to face one of the victims that saw you stab their sister-in-law for absolutely no reason, and that's what you're speaking of. I present to you there is no remorse. There's not. And I also present to you that the only thing that keeps me coming here, because this is cruel and unusual punishment. This family has to relive October 15, 1984, over and over and over and over and over and over again. And I have committed, and I will continue to do that, no matter how hard. For my safety, for your safety, even for this lady's safety and this lady's safety, because I truly believe that every woman in this state is at risk if this man gets out. It's not just about being a victim. It's about being a woman who has to face this kind of terror. I can imagine what my aunt was going through as that knife was going through her throat a million times by some man she had no idea who he was. This was a young woman who had her whole life and a beautiful, beautiful daughter that she loved dearly, that she thought she was going to be able to raise. The only thing that I can get out of my aunt's murder that makes me sleep okay at night as I feel, had it not been for her murder, there would have been several more. So when I think of her dying, her sacrifice, the ultimate sacrifice, her life, that ultimate sacrifice saved countless other women in my opinion, and that's the only thing that gets me through it. I feel that she is a hero, even though it had to happen the way it happened. So I hope they could seriously consider. I don't think there was a time frame. This man was convicted of first degree murder. He was sentenced to life. I hope that you guys consider. There is nothing that can change that. There's no class that can help that. There's not. And I really, really hope, knowing that this man still taunted a victim not even 2 years ago, speaks volumes in my opinion, and I hope that it speaks volumes in yours.
Okay, well, thank you, Ms. Nelson.
Yes.
I'm going to say the board has some questions for you. And the board has no questions for you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Martha Pino, sister of
Luke. And what is your last name?
Martha Rash.
Martha Rash?
Yes.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Rash.
Well, I'd like to thank you, sir, for asking the hard questions. And I'd like to thank you, sir, for pointing out the irritability and the annoyance that you could sense, because we're sensing it as well. But thank you for bringing that up. The hard question that Mr. Radwell could not answer, what made you attack? He had two truths in his statement. He had a burst of anger, and that he has to pay for his crime. I agree, he does have to pay for his crime. But the burst of anger, that's what made him attack. At the time that my sister was killed, I worked for the Department of Corrections. I was a corrections service officer. At the time, I was working at Perryville Prison. When this crime was committed and he was took to the Department of Corrections, he was seen by Dr. Alex Garabedian, who was a friend of mine. I stayed with the department for exactly 1 year after this death. I found that I could no longer be in the environment and be fair and be objective. I just found that I could no longer do my job. Dr. Garabedian at this time is now the administrator of the Perryville Prison. And as a friend of mine, he could see that I was no longer the person that I used to be. So one day he took me to lunch and he said to me, I probably shouldn't be having this conversation with you, he said, but you are my friend. You need closure. You need to heal. As a doctor, I feel an obligation to help you. And Dr. Garabedian gave me the story that Mr. Radloff gave to him when he was taken in. The burst of anger, where does it come from? Mr. Radloff had been following my sister for many weeks prior to the death. Mr. Radloff first noticed her walking around in the apartment complex with her infant daughter. Thought they were both beautiful. He felt protected by them. He followed them everywhere. His words, if they went across the street to Alpha Beta, I followed to make sure that she was safe. If she went down the street to visit her sister, I followed and waited outside to make sure she was safe. And Mr. Garabedian said to me, he became infatuated to the point with your sister that he felt he was in love. Shortly after, my brother-in-law, my sister's husband, came home to visit and was there visiting for some time. This enraged Mr. Radloff to see what he thought was his girlfriend with another man who was rivaling her husband. That's where the rage came from. That's why this resembles a crime of passion. The morning that this happened, he had already determined that he was going to confront my sister. He happened to be outside when he saw her driving up and noticed that today she was alone. Normally she was with another sister who they all carpool together. But today she was alone. And so he thought, this is the time to confront her. How did he get my sister to stop? She was in her vehicle. He motioned to her just like this, pointing to the time, asking her, do you know what time it is? My sister didn't show fear because apparently she maybe knew him as a tenant as well as she was. She stopped her vehicle, and when she put her arm up to look at the watch, he grabbed her at that point, pulled her from the vehicle, and began to stab her, and yelling the whole time, "You have been, bitch. After everything that I've done for you, you do this to me." There were witnesses there that said they did not get involved because they thought this was a domestic violence affair. That doesn't make sense to me either, because if you see someone being attacked, it doesn't take a whole lot to pick up the phone and say, "Hey, someone's getting attacked." The drugs, I mean, you know, that's an excuse, I think. I too was born and raised poor. I do not do drugs. I've never committed a crime. I'm a productive citizen. We make choices. I don't think that Mr. Radloff's disciplinary record is impressive at all. I mean, okay, he was out. He's corrected us by a month. So what, he lasted a full year on the street before he committed this crime? I don't think that's anything really to be proud of. The last, what, 8 years, you say his disciplinary record has been semi-clean. That he's not a member of a gang, okay, it's kind of hard to get involved. I think when you're probably spending a lot of time in protective custody. We watched Ruby's daughter grow. And as she got older, sisters, there remained sisters, there were six, there are five of us now. We all did our best to be surrogate mothers, if you will, to try to be there for her at times when we thought it was extra special for her to have a mother. And I think we probably did a really good job. And I say that because when she was married, she honored each and every one of us in a way that I think she wished she could have honored her mother. She asked us all to stand with her. She asked us all to wear the same color. She asked us all to be there as her mother. And we were. We were very proud to be there. I agree with my niece. I too have a fear about his, maybe he will, after sitting in prison all these years, have some anger against each and every one of us who has not given up, not forgotten. I do have that fear. We have family still in the city. I do have that fear. I'm not going to deny it. His crime was murder. And the sentence was life. And I understand the daughter wanting her parent back, but we want her sister back. We can't have that. So I think it brings us somewhat measured comfort, if you will, as knowing that he is at least paying for that crime. I would respectfully ask that you please deny. Her mother is now 88 years old. She has Alzheimer's. Thank God. Because she no longer remembers that part, that she was just with me yesterday, and I asked her to try to help her brain. I'm always asking her mom, what are the 12 months, what are the, you know, the counts of 10. She likes to talk about her children. And here's the thing that's never left her mind. She knows she had 11 children. And she knows that one of them was Ruby. She doesn't ask anymore, how did she die? And we don't tell her because it would be cruel. I would just ask that you please deny. I just don't think that he has shown that this crime, that he would be committed again. I just think that it would, if not in a year, in two, maybe three. But eventually, something's going to happen.
Okay, thank you. Let me see if the board has any questions. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. I'm not going to public speaking, but I have to.
I was 9 years old when this happened, and there's a lot of things from my childhood I don't remember, but I will never forget the day this happened. I won't forget being picked up from school. I won't forget all of us driving to my grandparents' house, them driving up, being told my aunt had been killed, my grandmother collapsing. I will never forget that day. I agree with Ms. Kimber and what she stated about people make mistakes. We all do, and it's certainly true, but not everyone makes mistakes that takes away a wife, a daughter, a sister, an aunt, most importantly, a mother. And it was so important for me to be here today for my cousin who lost her mother, knowing how difficult it would be for her to be here. So that is why I'm in here. As far as Mr. Redwell, and not having disciplinary infractions the past few years, seeming like he's somewhat stable. He's also in a structured environment, limited access to females. In my opinion, I feel like he's institutionalized. He's been incarcerated almost all his life. So I'm not confident that if he gets released, he wouldn't regress or have another anger issue and lash out at another person. I work in a probation office, and I hear about people saying people who have been in custody that long, it's not easy for them when they get out and they choose to go back to custody. And so I just don't feel letting him out is in the public's best interest, because if he releases and finds it is a bigger struggle than he thought it was going to be, I don't know that anyone, male or female, would be safe. So I'm here to ask that he doesn't get released.
Thank you. Except the board has any questions. Okay, send the board. Thank you.
My name is December White, and I am the daughter of Lucy White. Thank you for allowing me to address you today. It's hard to put together a statement that doesn't include all of my 34 years without my mother and all those difficult experiences. But I want some more information, and it helps me to make sense of some of my anxieties that I have. And so I want to just tell you two stories about myself. I grew up in a household with a father who loved me dearly, but he was a little bit removed because of the trauma that he experienced with the death of my mother, and then a few days later, the death of his father. I had my father, then I also had my mother's family, and they were amazing. Always there, we've always had big family get-togethers, and I thought that those were the best of times, being able to be around my cousins, being able to be around my aunts and uncles. It wasn't until they all started having kids, and they all started loving their kids just a little bit more than they loved me, that I realized how much of an outsider I was. Then it started making me think, well, before I wanted to have 12 kids and have a big house and have all these cousins running around, so we have a big group of family members. And I realized I can't have kids. How could I have kids and one day then me being taken from them and them being alone and not having anyone to love them when their mother loved them? That's my first story. That's the biggest thing that has changed in my life, I would say, or the biggest thing that impacts me the most. A lot of people tell me, you're going to be the best mother. How do I know that? That's the first story. The second story, my husband and I, he asked me to go back to work, but my husband is in the process of dying from pancreatic belly, and every single home I looked at, I've been terrified of the ability of someone to look in my windows, being able to just knock on my door, So I have very limited options here in the valley. There's not many options where you have the doorman or you have someone who's going to watch over you or security guards. I'm terrified every single day, even when the person is behind bars. So I'm asking you to not grant release. I'm asking you to understand the impacts on many individuals, but I'm asking you to understand where I'm coming from. Understand, I guess, maybe there have been things that have happened over the 30 years, or maybe just the last couple of years, to have this individual be a little better of an inmate, but not the best citizen, not the person that I want to call neighbor. That's all.
Thank you. Board on the questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Lyle.
Before you make a decision, please take all that into consideration, we, as a family, do not want to see another family go through what we have been through in the last 30 some years. Thank you.
Yes, the board have any questions? Thank you. Ms. Nelson.
Karen, victim voices.
Can you just state your name again?
Certainly. Karen Kemper, the Arizona District Human Victims. The victim's voice is the loudest one in the room. And that's because it's the one that's speaking the truth and from the heart. There were some quotes by the inmate that I'd like to bring back before this board in my very brief comments. He said there was, quote, a burst of anger. He said he had a violent history. He also said something very revealing. Quote, state was right to put me in the institution. And then he told you what he thinks about remorse. He said, quote, never learned that, never taught it to me. Well, why don't we just all ask ourselves, does someone have to teach you remorse? Can it be taught? So much of what the victim families have said to you today is cause for concern. Martha talked to you about his explanation for killing Louis White was that he had a protective relationship with her. He had no relationship with her. That is just it's a fantasy of his mind. It's his explanation. And his explanation changes. You've heard that. Some days it's, oh, the drugs made me do it. But when he talked to police, well, he really didn't have an explanation. And he went about that day, business as usual, after brutally murdering someone, as they cried out for help. This is not an individual who has proven to you that while institutionalized, he has made a full recovery, that he's completely remorseful, and that it would be absolutely safe for this community to have him in their presence. In fact, the opposite is true. There is no safe return of inmate Radloff. And for all those reasons, and for really more the reasons that the victims have cited to you today, and for his own record, we ask that he be allowed to serve his life sentence. Thank you.
Okay, if there be no more victims, Mr. Radloff, we're going to come back to you, sir. I'm going to either, and it's going to be your choice, Mr. Radloff, to give you, Mr. Radloff, the opportunity to make any final statements before the board goes into discussion, or to have your attorney, Mrs. Giesel, make the statement. So that is your choice as to what you would like to have done.
I think I go with my attorney, sir.
Okay.
Well, I'd like to point that I'm prescient, that's the word that we think in the newspaper this morning, and I can foresee something, but I'm not. This is a hard case, that's where we start. It's a very hard case. And I never correct victims. I never second-guess victims. I never try to point out anything that might be factually erroneous that they presented. If you consider the victim's standpoint, the victim's viewpoint, you would never release Mr. Rackley. And the law would not provide for Mr. Rackley to be released. That's what makes these cases hard, because every time you balance what the law requires and what an inmate seeks with
those powerful, sad, tragic victim stories, you have to make a balance, and that's it. I hope we all tend to watch the speakers, but when I do these, when I do hearings and victims are testifying, I watch the defendant. So I hope that you guys watch Mr. Radloff as I did throughout those victims' testimony, because you would have seen him put his head down, you would have seen some tears, and you would have seen him take his glasses off. His body language changed, he moved forward, he put his head down, he listened. Now we know eyewitnesses are terrible at recounting what happened at the scene. My brother-in-law's at the police crime lab forever, and we used to talk about that. And I learned to watch victims, and not watch victims, but to watch defendants. So I hope that you all watch Mr. Radloff, because when appearing curt or answering a question or using imprecise terms like probation and parole, it takes the young lawyers that we deal with 5 years more than dudes, and then I do some sometimes. So I hope you watched him, because that's the best evidence you've got right now to see his reaction to the hard, cold reality of the heinous consequences of a heinous crime that he committed. You've got, as I said, a short chain. You got a choke chain, you've got a short one. You can use it and you can do what the community correction system is there for. You can listen to the victims, and you can certainly, obviously you do, and on the basis of what they said, you won't release them. You have a more complex calculus, if you will, and that's tough. Mr. Radloff is listening. He's looking down. He's paying attention. But at the end of the day, I cannot, as the victim's lawyer, nobody can give you 100% certainty that anybody you release from prison won't re-offend, that they won't commit the same or worse, different crime, and you just use your skills and your knowledge and your experience, which are all substantial in different fields, before you even came to this one. And you have to see what you could do to balance inmate rights, the law, the victims, in a way that is the highest probability that if you release him, it's going to be a successful case. What he's demonstrated, most importantly, I think, in his prison time, is that he does get engaged in programs. He did everything he was asked. He's kept a clean disciplinary record for 34 years with three little minor exceptions. And when you look at all the other risk factors that we talked about, there were. If the board is uncomfortable by the lack of scientific evidence, the lack of a full-blown behavioral risk assessment, then set it off 6 months and we'll come back and try to get that. But I do not expect these wonderful, this family. I have daughters these kids age. I wish my kids had grown up with this.
Ms. Kingsley, I'm going to ask you to address
it. Sure, too. Absolutely. And I don't mean any disrespect. This is a wonderful family. No risk assessment is ever, no piece of paper by a PhD or an MD or a blah, 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 is ever going to convince them that he should be released. They can't, nobody can expect that. So that risk assessment, we'll get it, set it off for 6 months, we will get it. And we'll get the best one that we can get. We've got some community donors who are going to hopefully pay for it. But what piece of paper is going to help them? Nor should we're not ever asking anybody a big to say, oh, but look what Dr. So-and-so says, no. But we will, if it enables this board to tackle the complex calculus that we have. So, thank you very much. And I think I speak for Mr. Radloff, but I'll let him say thank you in his own voice.
Thank you.
him because he should. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am.
All right, the board's now, going to go into discussion. Mr. Radloff, I am going to ask you to remain on the phone so you can hear the discussion taking place amongst the board members. It may appear as though we're talking with you, sir, but we're only going to be talking amongst ourselves. At that time, we will make a decision as to what the board is going to grant or deny you absolute discharge, record of parole, or home arrest at that time. But I need you to remain silent while the board is in discussion. Do you understand, sir?
Yes, sir.
All right, sir. We're now going into discussion. You had an opportunity to listen to the victims as well as the inmates' representatives on this case. This was a very brutal murder of a female that didn't know Mr. Radloff, that she was brutally stabbed and taken to the hospital and died upon her arrival to the hospital. According to the information that we have, Mr. Radloff did not turn himself in. It was his foster sister who noticed the police and everything in the area, who informed the police that he had come there. He had blood drops that were there at the door, and some, I think, on his clothing. And he came to the house, he changed clothes, and he left, and he went about the rest of his day. And through subsequent investigation, he was arrested. He has had a very troubled life as a juvenile and suffered from some abuse. And according to the information that we have, he did do cocaine, he freebased, and he was also experimenting with LSD at the time that this incident occurred. He has been interviewed by several, as a young man, not in the recent times, but as a young man when this incident occurred. He's been interviewed by several psychologists, in which Holloman kind of came to the conclusion that he was aware of what he was doing at the time that this incident occurred. He did also say that he basically had a kind of a anti-social behavior, something that really concerns me at this point in the stage is that he has exhibited from a young age this boyism attitude about females where he, and I'm just so that I have the record straight, I'm just going to pull out the court documents that in May of 1977, he entered the bedroom of a female, and he was scared away by her screaming. As a result, he was committed himself to the state hospital. Then in September of 77, he cut a window screen and opened curtains in order to observe a female victim in her bedroom. He was placed on probation for that incident, and he ran away from his foster parents. And then it says that in December of 1980, he entered the bedroom of a female and assaulted her with a knife, which is what he was sentenced to, a five-year sentence. That he was incarcerated. I want to correct something. There's one part in the objection letter from the county attorney's office that says he was on parole at the time he committed this offense. However, according to the information that I was trying to research to make sure, says that he went to prison on March 2nd of 1981, he was paroled in January of 1984. His supervision over parole ended on July 9th, 1984, and then this incident occurred 3 months after he was off of his parole when this incident happened. And Clark and I really usually don't go into this, but I would tell you that it's just been, in my experience, I served 21 years on the police department. I worked robbery, homicide, did my last 6 years in the homicide. I've gone to court and I have testified in court as an expert interviewer, and I do know, you know, the examples of looking and interviewing someone. So I've also dealt in an undercover capacity and observed and worked with people doing drugs and LSD, and back in that time was probably one of the most powerful hallucinating drugs that you could absolutely take. However, it doesn't appear that from the information that I've read in this report that he was hallucinating or on the drugs, and according to some of the testimony that we've had here, that he wasn't, that he was doing his regular routine of getting up in the morning, going outside, smoking a cigarette, and walking around the apartments, waiting on his girlfriend to actually go to work. It'll tell you that at this point in time, and I do understand the family when they say they feel as though this is a torture for them to have to come. However, we're following the law, and that's what the law requires to actually happen to hold these hearings when a person is eligible to come up for parole. And until that law is changed, then we have an obligation to follow through on that. One of our major obligations is to make sure that that we feel when we do make a decision that the person that, if given parole, will not go out, and we feel as though there's a strong likelihood that that person would not reoffend. There, I would tell you that at this point in time, I don't feel that Mr. Redlaw would not reoffend if he was released. It doesn't appear that he's addressed these issues that he's had with voyeurism. When asked why he committed this attack on this female, he just simply stated that he had a flashback from his mother that took him, that he had a lot of anger that spilled up. He admitted himself and stated that he had a history of violent behavior. And I know he's been in prison, and since he's been incarcerated the last years, he's not had a lot of crime that was actually committed. But I tell you, just talking to him and not having a reason and understanding why he attacked this, with him denying those acts of voyeurism that he's actually been having, that there's something going on. And I really feel as though Mr. Redlaw would be a threat to the community if actually released, whether he was released on home arrest, regular parole, or he received absolute discharge. I think that he would really think that it doesn't seem as though the issues that has caused him have been resolved. And since he's been incarcerated, he has not had an opportunity to act out those aggressions toward females. Those aggressions were toward females, and the voyeurism was toward females, and his act that he committed was toward females. In every psychological examination, it would appear that he was aware and conscious and knew what he was doing and qualified to stand trial. So that's just my opinion. I'm willing to listen to the rest of my colleagues at this time. Mr. Quinones.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. And I'm going to read from some notes that I wrote down, but I'd like to continue the discussion by saying that we live in a world overwhelmed with trauma, poverty, and addiction, and I'm never satisfied when it's suggested that such conditions are the reason for a violent, heinous crime, not to mention an escalation of violence. I'm concerned about what's underneath. That granting home arrest or whether the parole to Mr. Redlaw serves the interest of justice, and his prison sentence allows for the very real possibility of life. Possibility of life. And I'll just hand it over from there.
Mr. Neal.
Yes, I'll keep you to date. I agree with Mr. Kinnell on the issue of upbringing. There are unfortunate, very unfortunate, but there are thousands of people out there that grew up in very similar and sometimes worse conditions that don't escalate their criminal behavior to murder. So I can't buy into the background being the justification cause or even the consideration for what's going on now. And of course, that was some time ago. And we went on and on about the history, but current behavior is more concern for, for granting some type of release. The issue of his good record in when he was incarcerated, if you look at the dates and everything, even the dates of when his disciplinary record started to settle down and he behaved himself more, coincides with a considerable amount of protected custody, which in your protected custody is a little hard to give to get in trouble with other inmates and things like that. But as far as today's hearing goes, I am not satisfied at all with Mr. Grant's his recollections of triggers and stuff like that. He seemed to talk around in circles about what caused him to do that and what was going on with him. And I did observe him during the victim's statements, and I didn't see a whole lot of what I would call true remorse or emotions based on what they were saying. But I'm not at all convinced that if he was on some type of release, he would not be a considerable danger to society. So I'm not favored this time making any type of release for this rather.
Mr. Rittenhouse.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Johnson. I agree with all of my colleagues. I just kind of approach it from a different angle, and that is that this board is responsible to make its decisions in a way that protects the public. And as I heard the victims talk today, I heard fear in their voices, and they're certainly members of the public. So I cannot support returning Mr. Radoff to the community.
Dr.
Radoff.
Thank you so much, Mr. Johnson. Thank you, Mr. Johnson, for conducting this hearing today. I also wish to thank the both sides for being here and being professional, because we know that this is an emotional situation on both sides. As always, this board, it is my desire that this board would be professional and show respect for all, and as we listen and when we have to make decisions. It's not very hard, very easy to sit up here and make these decisions, but that's the responsibility of this board, and I think that when the governor and members of the legislature and members of the Senate permit us to sit here, that's their expectations, and to make sure that we have all of the facts and to make decisions. Each of us act independent of each other. And that's one reason we cannot, unfortunately or fortunately, we cannot suggest to an inmate or a victim what they should, if they are not released at this time, what they can expect the next time. Because one thing we don't know, as you know, this board changes from time to time. I think that we don't know who will be on the board. I think I'm the only one sitting up here today who's been on the board in any of his hearings in the past. I was here in 14, 15, 16, and then I'm here in 18. So it varies, therefore we cannot say what would happen. But having said that, I think that each of us, we use our own experiences to say what is best for the community, what is best for each side. And at this time, I'm going to just be very brief and just say, I concur with my colleagues. Thank you.
Okay, therefore, I'm going to make a motion to deny Mr. Radloff 31412 Reverend Parole, or 41-1604 home arrest, or 31411 absolute discharge. That would be my motion.
Second.
Agreed.
Agreed.
went to the Ashland Blender setup. I'm going to mark the reason for it now that it was a serious and violent offense. It was a loss of human life. I'm going to mark it as a serious and deviant offense too. I'm going to mark trauma to the victims, as you heard there was trauma to the victim still. I'm also going to mark age of the victim, as this was a young mother that's been testified to that was taken away from her daughter. Mark history of continued substance abuse, history of assault and behavior, prior criminal history. I'm also going to mark a repeat offender since as a juvenile and as a adult, he did it for 5 years. Mark that he does have a history of, did have a history of assault and behavior. I'm going to mark lack of programming because you guys take a lack of programming. You didn't have a release plan to stay with his daughter. Those are going to be my reasons for the left sense. Anything else? I do also want to note that there were letters of support from Mr. Radloff, as well as several letters of support for him not to be released, but the victim and the victim's family, as well as the county attorney's office, Maricopa County Attorney's Office, or the Office of Yuma County Attorney. So that will be my most important. Have anything additional to put right there? Mr. Radloff?
Yes, sir.
So the board has made a decision to deny you regular parole, home arrest, or absolute discharge at this time. We've also asked for a 1-year setup. You will be certified by the Department of Corrections on or about or sometime in about a year to come back before this board, sir. Mr. Radloff, I do want to thank you for taking the time and opportunity for appearing before this board. I want to thank all the supporters of Mr. Radloff, as well as the victim witness supporters that were here today. I want to also thank you for taking the opportunity and time to come down and appear before this board. That is going to conclude the hearing at this time. Thank you, Mr. Radloff.
Thank you. Victims, would you please...